We're the only agency in the country that's been cross-deputized as postal inspectors, whereas other law enforcement agencies just aren't allowed to even look at mail.
Searching out illegal drugs and alcohol in Western Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, August 19th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, the Catholic Church in Amonok works to move on from the sex abuse scandal.
It's your daily life that makes you a church. A church is not a pastor.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender. And by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
Over $1 million in illegal drugs and over $330,000 worth of alcohol was seized last year in Western Alaska. The state-run drug unit for the area has investigators who regularly check luggage and even the mail, and that's being sent to those remote communities. From KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes has more.
That's the sound of a small box of diapers getting set on a table. Well, the box is labeled diapers on the outside, but clearly there's something else inside.
So what we have here is a box containing alcohol that was going to one of the local option communities here in Western Alaska.
She's an investigator with WANT, which stands for the Western Alaska Alcohol and Narcotics Team, which is a branch of the Alaska State Troopers. She's not allowed to give her name because part of her job is working as an undercover agent in the villages.
How much alcohol is in there?
In this box, there's 6 bottles of alcohol.
Is that about normal?
It's an average. This box is a Huggies box, and a lot of people, what they'll do is they'll pack the alcohol in the diapers to kind of conceal the bottles, as well as the sound that the bottles will make.
More and more reports of alcohol and drug busts have been in the news lately in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. Just this week, WANT troopers released reports of seizing about 50 grams of marijuana from a person at the Bethel Airport who was on her way to Nunavak Island. 41 more grams of pot was seized in a mailing package hidden inside a kitchen appliance. Another pound of marijuana was seized through the mail, heading from Anchorage to a village. That had a street value of $22,000. Then there was the case of 21 grams of pot thrown over the outside fence of the state jail in Bethel. And that's just this week in the YK Delta. There are plenty of other busts happening through WANT's other posts in Dillingham, Kotzebue, and Nome. But these reports aren't because there are actually more alcohol or pot busts going on.
I haven't seen any significant spike one way or the other.
Lieutenant Chris Thompson oversees WANT from Anchorage and says the reason we're seeing more busts is because there's a new push to write up more public reports.
Before it wasn't, you know, just wasn't a priority to do that sort of thing. Now we're doing it.
So that means it's normal for people to get busted regularly in Western Alaska for bootlegging. It's an area where most crimes are alcohol-related, and many villages have voted to ban alcohol entirely. But even though busts are normal, you probably won't see it happening. That's because WANT investigators often wear street clothes.
So that they can move around in a manner that doesn't necessarily pique people's interest, you know, at the airport or when they're doing cargo stuff. It just makes for a better relationship with these businesses who we rely on to do the job.
Although they do conduct undercover operations, Thompson says that's not their main focus. Mostly what they do are interdictions.
That's contacting passengers as they travel. That's going to the local airlines that do cargo and, you know, checking cargo as it's going out to local option communities and various other places.
One of those other places is the post office. And Thompson says that sets Alaska State Troopers apart from others in the country.
We're the only agency in the country that's been cross-deputized as postal inspectors. So our people are able to do mail, whereas other law enforcement agencies just aren't allowed to even look at mail.
Checking out the mail is a major component in busting dealers in Western Alaska, particularly for drugs. According to WANT's 2010 report, $475,000 worth of illegal drugs was seized from parcel posts, along with $90,000 worth of alcohol. The drugs were mostly marijuana, but it also included prescription drugs, meth, and heroin, all three of which the report says are on the rise. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
This week, the embattled Society of Jesus Oregon Province emerged from Chapter 11 bankruptcy. The province oversees Jesuit activities in five states, and under their watch, hundreds of children were sexually abused by priests and volunteers. Nowhere have more victims come forward than in western Alaska. The Yupik Eskimo community of Amonok was hit hard by the abuse. Court documents detail decades of clerical abuse there, mostly in the 1960s and 70s. Despite the pain that was inflicted there years ago, many in the community still embrace the Catholic faith. From Station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson reports.
The Sacred Heart Church in Amonok sits right on the riverbank of the Yukon. Outside, the weather is calm. Inside, however, the feeling is a bit different.
Oh, excited.
That's Nora Westlock and mother of the groom. Today, her youngest child will be married. Like the other siblings, they were all married here at Sacred Heart, and that's important to her.
I was raised as Catholic, and I even got married in Catholic church, too, about going on 40 years.
Villagers have traveled today by boat or bush plane to be here. In the crowd is Amonok resident and parishioner Nick Tucker. He attends church every Sunday for a simple reason.
We go to church because we need God.
He says he never saw any of the clergy abuse that occurred over the decades, but he's glad it came to light so that it can be dealt with. Tucker is now 66 years old. He's seen a lot of priests and Jesuits come through his village. None of them were perfect, he says, but that's just like everybody he knows.
We want to hear that somebody's bad, you know. No, that's not the case. We're human beings. We certainly will mess up.
He's not sure where all the blame should go. But for him, it's not really important, because for him, the church is much more than just a priest and more than an institution.
It's your daily life that makes you a church. A church is not a pastor. The church is the message of God already in the Bible for you to live.
Then there were others who could only think of the church as made up of people, some of whom had sexually abused them or relatives.
That's Bishop Donald Kettler. He heads the Catholic Diocese of Fairbanks.
And for many of those, they turned away from the church.
Kettler has visited with several survivors of the abuse. He says what the church can do now is try and help victims and their families. For that, the diocese contracted clinical therapist Bob Cheney, who's seen firsthand the effects of clergy abuse.
Anyone who's been victimized is trying to do something about it. Even if it's drink themselves to death.
The Lower Yukon has some of the highest rates of premature death in the country. Many blame the ills on poverty and historical trauma going back to early westernization. Cheney says that the clerical abuse, too, has lingering effects in the region.
You have these explosions of these emotions. People get hurt. People get arrested.
Cheney's work is meant to help the victims understand the pain so they can reclaim their lives. Whether that means a life with the church will be up to the victims, says Bishop Kettler. But he says the diocese is leaving their doors wide open.
Maybe, I hope, with the healing that we've provided, that they become not blocked in their coming to God because of what happened to them in the church.
Back at the wedding, Deacon Raymond Waska Sr. gives communion.
Hey, Lord, bless you. What a question.
After the ceremony, guests congratulate the new couple, while their boy cries impatiently for their attention. I sit with Waska to discuss his work. Waska is Yupik and carries much of the church's water in Amonok.
It's not a test. We need somebody to lead it when there's a funeral, at the marriage, or baptism, or preparing marriage life.
Internationally, seminary schools are on the decline. In the Yukon Delta, just four residing priests cover 20 villages in a roadless area the size of Oregon. The church needs local deacons to carry the faith, and Waska says his community needs the church even more.
Our people, they used to talk about, in their language, unknown maker, unknown God. He said there's something that's mighty, something that's big, that created a world, something takes care of animals, but they couldn't explain it. That was before the Christians came over.
From the pew, Nick Tucker hopes survivors find someone that will help with their pain, whether it's a deacon or a therapist or a friend. Either way, he says, it could still take more time.
But then it has taken 2,000 years, even just to get the touch of people to the message of God. So it continues in our village. So it shall continue in the village. And God is 2,000 years patient.
The Catholic Diocese says counseling services are available to any victims in any village that requests them. Reporting from Imanak, I'm Shane Iverson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, aboard the last Flagstop train in the country.
Oh yeah, it's exciting. You meet some real characters out here. I mean, it's cool. It's a rare person that can spend time here and make a life.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
A family of four that survived a plane crash near McGrath will get financial help. NEA Alaska President Barb Angayak says a Wells Fargo account has been set up to take donations to help Don and Rosemary Evans and their two young children. The family was on their way to Anvik, where the two adults were to begin teaching school, when the plane they were on crashed last Saturday evening.
It was the idea of the school district. Their board met last Monday, I believe, and made some decisions and tried to do everything they could to support this family in this situation.
The plane had been chartered by the school district. The Evanses spent a rough night awaiting rescuers who were unable to reach the crash site until Sunday morning. The Evanses were on the payroll of the school district when the accident occurred, although their insurance was not scheduled to kick in until September 1st. The Iditarod School Board has since changed the start date to August 1st, and the family is fully covered, according to Karen Lattigard, superintendent of the Iditarod School District. Lattigard says classes in Anvik will begin on Monday, despite the Evans' hospitalization and the loss of longtime Anvik teacher Julia Walker, who was killed in the crash along with pilot Ernie Chase. Lattigard says retired teachers will work at Anvik on a temporary basis until the Evans' recover from their injuries.
Well, we'd certainly love to have them back in Anvik, and when they're ready to go back, we will bring them back there to teach. But I don't have that information, and as to when, I believe there's going to be quite a bit of physical therapy. So we'll just keep our fingers crossed for them.
Those who want to help the Evanses can make a contribution to the Evans Family Fund at any Wells Fargo branch. The account number is 5969770287. The International Pacific Halibut Commission is offering a reward for a couple of pieces of scientific equipment that have been lost in waters off Alaska. KDLG's Mike Mason has the details.
Back in 2009, the IPHC launched a program to collect oceanographic data alongside survey fishing data. The executive director of the International Pacific Halibut Commission is Bruce Lehman. He says the missing pieces of equipment are water column profilers.
We received a grant from NOAA a couple of years ago to equip all of our survey vessels with these profilers. And what the profilers do is that for each time we do some of our survey fishing, and we have something like 1,280 stations between Oregon and the Bering Sea and the end of the Aleutians, at each one of those stations we deploy this profiler, and it goes down through the water column and it measures salinity, temperature, pH, dissolved oxygen, and chlorophyll content. So it gives us a fairly good snapshot of the whole coast here, and this is a very important data set to us. We're sharing it with all kinds of other users, and it gives us a very good profile of what the whole coast looks like during the time of our survey.
The vast majority of the water column profilers have been retrieved, but two of the profilers remain on the fishing grounds. The profilers weigh about 60 pounds and are housed inside a steel cage. One of the profilers was lost in late July of 2009 off the east side of Kodiak Island. The profiler is thought to be sitting hard on the bottom, and the International Pacific Halibut Commission believes that it may be snagged by fishing or other gear. The second missing profiler was lost this last June on the south side of Adak Island. Lehman says it's possible vessels might be able to locate the missing water profilers if they have their depth sounders on.
Particularly for the one that's off Kodiak Island, it doesn't have the floats on top, but it's sitting on hard bottom, and you would get a little bit of a bump in there. But the one that's off Adak Island, you can actually see the floats on your echo sounder if you're going by.
In an effort to get the expensive pieces of equipment back, the International Pacific Halibut Commission is offering a $1,500 reward for each water column profiler. Lehman says the staff at the IPHC is still holding out hope that the profilers can be found and retrieved.
You know, we certainly would like to see them again, and we think that the $1,500 might be enough incentive so people might actually go looking for them. It's sort of a small thing in a large area, but we have some fairly precise location information on it, so we would dearly like to get them back because they do have important data on them, plus they're reusable for us. They're fairly durable pieces of equipment.
Details about the reward and the approximate location and depth of the missing water column profilers can be found on the website of the International Pacific Halibut Commission at iphc.washington.edu. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alaska Business Monthly, providing a source for statewide in-depth business news on Twitter at AKBusinessMonth or Facebook.
Do you know a nonprofit executive or tribal leader who is at risk for job burnout? Nominate them for a Rasmussen Foundation sabbatical, which provides paid time away for personal renewal and growth. Go to Rasmussen.org for more information, but don't wait. Nominees must complete an application by October 1st. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Sue Dio. Today on AK, we take a ride on the Flagstop train. Remote homes and cabins are a mainstay of life in the 49th state. Hardy Alaskans don't consider it a burden to build on a property that's only accessible by float plane, boat, or snow machine. And then there's the train. In an area north of Tokitna, the last true whistle-stop train in the country is the only access cabin owners have to their wilderness retreats. APRN's Annie Feit rode along recently and has the story.
The train is called the Hurricane Turn, which sounds a bit ominous, but as I settle into a seat, the passenger directly across from me looks to be the friendly sort. You know the type, kind eyes, a calm demeanor, well-groomed.
This is Raven. She's a good dog. She's probably the smartest dog I've ever had.
Rules, like no dogs allowed, are in short supply on this train. But there is no shortage of rugged Alaskans with plenty of stories to tell. Raven's owner, Michelle Finley, grew up riding the train. Her parents raised her on a homestead 30 miles from Talkeetna. As a kid, the Hurricane Turn was her only link to the outside world. Now she lives in Eagle River, and it's a link to her past.
Going up to the homestead, that's our sanity time. So we go up there just to kind of recover our balance.
Two of Michelle's teenage sons are with her on the train. Greg Finley is excited to spend a weekend at the homestead, but it hasn't always been that way. When he was little, he was a reluctant visitor, mainly because he hated the smelly, bug-infested outhouse. But now he sees the appeal of a place where there's no phone, internet, or running water.
But the reason why I like it the most is because it's just like, there's no people for like miles. It's just like surreal sometimes because, you know, it's just nice to be alone.
The homestead is at mile 258.3, and it's a stop the engineer knows well. The train breaks at an opening in the trees. A small turquoise house is visible in the distance. Raven, Michelle, and her sons hop off as the crew waves goodbye.
Pick you up tomorrow.
For the Hurricane Turn's conductor, this is a new job. Wade Sherwood has been working for the Alaska Railroad for 30 years, but it's his first year on this train. And he says keeping track of the comings and goings of all the passengers was daunting when he started a few months ago.
Well, my word, yes, yeah. Well, if you don't know this job very well, and you come out here with all the different stops you have to make, and who's who, and whose gear goes where, it's intimidating. But now I got it all figured out, so it was pretty rough at first.
Occasionally, the train makes impromptu stops to pick up travelers who flag it down, but for the most part, Wade knows where people are going to get on and off, and he knows pretty much everyone by name.
Oh yeah, it's exciting. You meet some real characters out here. I mean, it's cool. And it's not an easy place, and it's a rare person that can spend time here and make a life. And they're all unique people in their own way.
Wade oversees the action on the hurricane turn, like the mayor of a small town.
Is that it?
Yeah.
Tom?
Yeah.
Is that your bag and your gun?
Yeah.
Okay.
And for locals riding the train, it's like taking a stroll down Main Street where you never know who you're going to run into. Tim Huffman is heading to his cabin for the weekend.
Yeah, you see people and get to know them and swap stories about whether the bears were putting new scratch marks on your door and whether the moose were in the yard and how hard it rained last weekend. It's really great.
Most of the passengers are like Tim, going to recreational cabins, but a few hardy Alaskans live out here year-round. Hardin Mevin built his home 34 years ago. He enjoys the lifestyle.
Not a lot of stress. We just deal with staying warm, making sure we have water, and making sure we have enough to eat. And then everything beyond that is your choosing.
One thing that connects these Alaskans is a desire to live or at least experience a very simple existence that rewards hard physical labor. 40 years ago, Ken Flynn staked out a property 2 miles off the tracks. It took him 5 years to build the 10x13 cabin. He met his wife, Julie, a few years later.
When I first met Ken, I said, why is this cabin so small? And he kind of gave me this dirty look because, you know, he felled all the trees and he built the cabin, and everything in the cabin came up on his back or somebody else's back, you know, well, mostly his. So that's why the cabin's small.
The Flynns hike into their place from the train, and at this time of year, that means a strenuous slog with heavy backpacks through thick underbrush and Devil's Club. When their stop comes up, they climb down from the baggage car, and Wade hands them their backpacks and trekking poles.
Got it. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
See you Sunday.
See you Sunday.
Bye.
Thanks.
Bye. Julie says it's always a little strange when the train pulls off and leaves them just standing there, on their own in the middle of a vast wilderness. But that's exactly how she and Ken like it.
Bye, Annie. Bye. Have fun.
For AK, I'm Annie Feit.
Now it's time for our weekly trip around the state for 300 villages. We'll head first to False Pass, a tiny fishing village in the Aleutian Islands, and then go way up north to Anaktuvik Pass in the Brooks Range.
Chris Emmerich in False Pass. Right off the end of Unimak Island, it's across at the end of the Alaska Peninsula, the first island. That's mostly what the residents here do, is they do fish. The people that are here live here year-round. There is seasonal stuff at the seafood plant, but they usually don't bring in that many more workers from the outside. We're just a big stopping point for everybody to refuel, and it's about a day's less travel around Unimak Island for the ships going to the Bering Sea or south to the Gulf of Alaska. Yeah, definitely there's a good influx of people from a little bit everywhere. Get sailing boats from New Zealand, fishing boats, a little bit of everything. There's one school here, it's fairly decent size, 2 classrooms. There's a teacher and 2 teacher's aides. That's what they did last year. Not too sure about this year. I think student count's about 7 students. Very mountainous and a lot of alder bushes. Great bear country. Yeah, we definitely have a ton of them around here. That's pretty much all that grows. Too windy for the bigger trees. You know, like I said, the alders do crazy here, but and the berries, but big trees just don't exist. Everybody here is very inviting. I worked on the fishing boats for about 6 years, and we stopped by here every year, so I knew what the area looked like. I was kind of familiar with it, and the people here are wonderful. Like a big family. Nobody's loaded out here, but, you know, we get by.
Rose Smid from Anaktuvik Pass. We're located nearly in the central of the Brooks Range, about 250 miles north of Fairbanks.
There's roughly about 350 people. Oh my goodness, the weather's dropped down to about 40 degrees, and it's usually foggy in the morning till about 10, 11 a.m. We got some sunshine today, finally. But yeah, it's been rainy. I know people are picking salmon berries and blueberries, and they had been fishing all summer, and they caught some caribou down south of the village just recently. The school actually just reopened the gymnasium up, so they have a night rec program where, you know, kids and adults can go down and do various things like play basketball or play badminton and stuff like that. Oh goodness, when you look out the window, you got these gorgeous mountains all the way around our community. It's just a really beautiful mountainous, you know, community with tundra around us and willows, because we don't have any trees up here because we're above the tree line. But yeah, it's definitely gorgeous. Just from being born and raised here, my own personal, you know, life, I wouldn't live anywhere else.
That was Chris Emmerich in False Pass and Rose Snid from Anaktuvuk Pass. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK on Alaska News Nightly. Tune in next week when we revisit the dying art of writing letters, the kind you can actually hold in your hand and store for generations in an old shoebox. I'm Sue Dia.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Angela Denning Barnes and Bethel, Shane Iverson and Amonic, and Mike Mason and Dillingham. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer, Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
And by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
The future of how Alaskans will produce the energy we need for our homes and businesses is uncertain. The Renewable Energy Alaska Project is committed to developing Alaska's vast renewable energy resources to create a clean, local, and sustainable energy supply. Learn more at realaska.org. This message sponsored by REAP, committed to creating a sustainable economic future for Alaska. A PFD reminder, check the status of your 2011 PFD application with My PFD Info online at pfd.alaska.gov. You can view or change your voluntary deductions until Wednesday, August 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.